is Kathy from the Stowe Street Emporium in Waterbury. We are thrilled to be part of our wonderful town this holiday season and want all to know about Waterbury's annual holiday stroll and River of Light Lantern Parade on Saturday, December 6th. Stroll into the Emporium and join us for cookies and refreshments all day long. And then at 5 o'clock, watch the parade, which starts at Thatcher Brook School and ends at Dacro Field with a bonfire and hot chocolate. The event is free to all, and this year's theme is Our Town. At the Emporium, we carry the best greeting cards and holiday box cards. Also, check out our kitchen items, home decor, wine and beer gadgets, men's and women's clothing and shoes, accessories, jewelry galore, children's apparel and gifts, and of course, loads of Christmas ornaments and stocking stuffers. Our holiday hours are 9:30 till 6 daily, Sundays 11 to 5. We look forward to seeing all our happy shoppers at the Stowe Street Emporium. Enter our world of magic at 23 Stowe Street in historic downtown Waterbury.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. Hey, a little sketchy out there on the highways this morning. Please be careful. Leave a little extra time if you're heading up towards the Champlain Valley. A couple of accidents this morning. I'm sure they're doing some work to still clear those out. Coming up on the program this morning in our second hour today, we're going to be joined by a couple of folks from the Public Assets Institute. That's a local think tank. Paul Cielo and Jack Hoffman will join us. And they've been making the case that they don't think that property taxes and school spending are as big a problem as many people out there think. And it seems to be almost universal that people think school spending is out of control. So we'll talk with them coming up in hour number two. That'll be after we get our White House report from our friends at Talk Radio News Service. We would love to take your phone calls throughout the program, one of the valuable parts of the program. And you can reach us at the usual phone numbers, 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to be chatting with a great historian. Patrick O'Donnell will join us. He has joined us a couple of times before on the program. First, then at the Colby Military Writers Symposium, where he was an award winner down there. He has chronicled and done recordings, audio recordings, of thousands of World War II vets. And I have to say, he's one of the most interesting people that I've had here on the program. He has a new book out, and he will be back on the program at 9:05 tomorrow. We begin this morning, we're going to talk a little bit about Lake Champlain, some of the other waterways, and some other environmental issues. And joining us here live in our studios, let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to David Mears, who is the Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Any difficulty getting in for you this morning?
I didn't have any real trouble, although there was at least one car off the road as I left Montpelier.
Didn't see anything from the helicopter?
Yeah, I wish.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, there's a state plane. Isn't there maybe a little state helicopter?
I'll put that in my next budget request.
Okay. Let's talk about Lake Champlain. And so I was thinking to myself, Dave, that, you know, I could spend the next 15 minutes here trying to beat up on you and how terrible this plan is that the state has come up with for Lake Champlain. I could sit here and try to point out some of the discrepancies and what the state funding that's been proposed and what needs to be spent. But then I thought maybe what I ought to do is instead just give you an opportunity here, because I think you're a bright guy. I think you're committed to the environment. But tell me, in what way the Environmental Protection Agency wants to see some deep reductions in the phosphorus load in Lake Champlain? It's been causing these terrible blue-green algae blooms in the middle of the summer. I think we all know what the problem is. The state has come up with a response to the EPA that's putting on the pressure, and it really appears inadequate and like weak tea. So can you help me here? How is it not those two things?
Well, I definitely think we need to do more. So I don't want to sit here and pretend like we've got it all dialed. In fact, one of the things that we got from a recent report out or set of public meetings with EPA was that our plan falls short in a few key ways. And so we know we have more that we need to do. But I'll just disagree with one thing that you said, which is that we're doing this because EPA is demanding it. You know, this is an issue, I think, as you know, Mark, that Vermonters care about. We're not engaged in trying to clean up Lake Champlain and restore it to its full health. just because EPA is telling us to do it. There's a broad swath of Vermonters, from farmers to businesses to communities, who realize that, you know, our public health, our ability to enjoy the place, the aesthetics, the ability to get out and boat and fish, and our businesses, you know, kind of our just general quality of life depend on our protecting the lake. And it's not just the lake, of course. The lake is fed by this broad network of rivers and streams that flow across the landscape. And even for communities, I'll pick on Cabot, you know, that may seem like they're far removed from Lake Champlain or part of that watershed. And while they may not get to use Lake Champlain all the time, they definitely care about the upper reaches of the Winooski River. And so there's a broad group of Vermonters that are engaged in this work. And so I just, that's the one comment I'd make. And then, so back to the your main point about, you know, is our plan sufficient? And one of the ways that I think it's important to understand how we approach this and how we came about the plan wasn't just kind of like seeing, you know, throwing some darts at the wall and seeing what sticks. We've done a fairly thoughtful, careful process of working through what are the main sources of pollution to the lake. And what are the ones that are the most cost-effective to deal with? And there's a few things that rose to the top of the list. The agricultural runoff was clearly an issue that we have to do better on. Stormwater runoff from our developed areas, from our parking lots and so forth. That's another major area. And then runoff from our roads, kind of a third major area. All areas that we haven't done a good enough job in the past doing. And it's not because there has been a lack of, you know, will or commitment. While I think we could have done more in some of these areas with a little more effort, it's been more of a structural problem. When you get to those issues, right, it's no longer about just going after a few sewage treatment plants or a few industrial facilities and putting stronger permit controls. All of a sudden, when you talk about stormwater runoff from farms, developed areas, and roads, we're all in. Like, there's not, you know, an inch of the Lake Champlain watershed where there isn't a person who's in some way contributing to the pollution problem. So then we have to start talking about a broader mix of tools. And we have relied very heavily in the past on education and outreach and assistance. And that has made some progress. We've had some incremental progress. But one of the things we learned was that just kind of doing that randomly, you know, working with just those people who are the willing victims of this kind of work, wasn't sufficient. So part of what our plan is doing is ramping up the level of regulatory oversight from the Agency of Agriculture, for instance, in the area of agriculture, using some of the tools that we've used in areas like Burlington that are more developed, and expanding those to reach a broader set of communities. Turning actually to the roads programs and saying, you know, we have these standards that we've incentivized people to use, but not everyone's using them. We need to require these to be in place. So those are all fairly heavy lifts that's going to require working with a lot of communities and a lot of businesses to do work that they haven't been asked to do yet. I feel pretty good that we are attacking the main issues and the places where there's the most cost effectiveness. So, but back to your comment about, is it falling short? One of the places that there's kind of two places in which EPA said our plan isn't sufficient, and it's more geographic and there's scientific and, you know, technical reasons for our problems. But it's not a failure of approach. In fact, for the majority of the Lake Champlain Basin, they said our plan is right on target. Said that if we did all the things that are in this plan for the majority of the lake, we're in good shape. We're headed in the right direction. The places where we're not are in the northern part of the lake, in Missisquoi Bay, and the southern part of the lake. And those are specific challenges because they're shallower. They tend to be warmer. The algae blooms are worse. So we have a bigger lift in terms of the need to reduce nutrient pollution. And they're largely agricultural. And that's been one of the areas we've struggled the most to kind of get the kinds of gains in pollution reduction. So we still have work to do, and that's my story. I'm sticking to it.
All right. So when EPA says that this plan is inadequate, they're really only talking about those specific areas. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes.
And they want to see a reduction of 36%. And I know you're somebody that likes to come up with plans that are realistic. Is that a realistic number to achieve?
It is realistic. There's no question in my mind that we can achieve it. There's also no question in my mind it's going to take time, and that we have to build the structures and foundations of programs. We can't just kind of, what I really don't want to do, and I've been encouraging elected officials across the state as we get into this, to not buy into anybody's theory that there's a one solution and a one quick fix idea, some new technology or some gee whiz bang up idea. This is going to require a sustained effort, which means we have to build the kind of the human systems, you know, whether it's a local government's ability to implement stormwater controls, some of the funding mechanisms, making sure we have, say, low-interest loan programs to help communities out, making sure that the farmers have the right tools and that we're telling them to do the right things. We haven't always consistently over time always asked our farmers to do exactly the right things. So just rushing around with our hair on fire isn't going to do it either. But we have, it isn't rocket science. It isn't, none of the, just as one example, you know, one of the very basic things that you do to control the pollution from stormwater is to collect it and slow it down. And when you start learning what the opportunities are for that and you drive across the landscape, drive through any community in Vermont, and once you've seen those tools, they start popping off the page at you. You start seeing all these opportunities. You start asking yourself, why is there a curb on the edge of the street that prevents the runoff from going out into the forested area or the landscape or the lawn or the meadow? If that rainwater wasn't contained and stuck in the street and forced into a storm drain, it would flow out into the landscape and infiltrate, and that's a natural way to control the pollution. We have many opportunities in Vermont to do that kind of work. We just have to do it.
244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free 877-291-8255. We'd love to hear your thoughts, questions, and comments. We're talking with the Department of Environmental Commission, Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner David Mears. Again, our number is 244-1777. Toll-free 877-291-8255. Can you say that the plan that you submitted to EPA will eventually result in these reductions getting to the point? Is it a question of time? Is that the question?
There is a question of time, but there's also a question of will. We actually have to implement the plan. It's just a plan. And while we have a very solid base, I feel really good about the work our department has been doing and is doing right now, as well as the work that the Agency of Agriculture is doing. And we're making real progress. I'm proud of the work that the farm community's doing, the development community up in Chittenden County in particular, and increasingly places like Rutland and St. Albans. There's a lot of really good work happening, but it's not happening fast enough, and it's not hitting the broad swath of categories of pollution I described. If we're really going to get after it, we have to broaden the effort, and we have to follow through on it. And that's an issue that we'll see play out, at least in Chapter 1, of this conversation over the next legislative session. This next session, from my perspective, is a really critical one. We've had a lot of conversations over the last 3 years in the legislature about what needs to be done, a lot of pressure, frankly, from legislators to do more. But now we need the legislature to step up with a package of funding and legislative authorities that will drive this effort home.
All right, let's talk some money here. There was a report that came out a few months ago, Dave, that said that in order to clean up the state's waterways, it would cost some $150 million over a decade. Is that accurate?
That was a report that came out about 3 years ago, and it was a report that was asked, like, what are the water-related investments that the state of Vermont should make? And it included drinking water infrastructure, water and wastewater and sewer infrastructure improvements, as well as the broader categories of how do we control stormwater, agricultural pollution runoff, and roads and the like. So it was a broader report than just, you know, what are the issues facing the Lake Champlain Basin. And when you add up all those costs, it's an accurate report in the sense that it's an accurate estimate. It was a good faith estimate. There was no kind of ginned up numbers in it. On the other hand, it was just an estimate, and it was broader than kind of just the kind of pollution control issues that I was describing. And it was also kind of not discriminate in the sense of, it said, like, if you added it all together, there are some things, as you look at a cost curve on these kinds of pollution controls, there are some things that, getting down to that last little tidbit of pollution reduction is very expensive. Some ways of controlling phosphorus are much more expensive than others. some of the least expensive ways are what I was just describing. You know, getting capturing runoff off of our roads and ditches and allowing it to infiltrate. That's not that expensive. So once you subtract out drinking water infrastructure and fixing all our sewer systems, which we should do, there's reasons to do that independent of water pollution in Lake Champlain. The cost is, frankly, a lot lower than $155 million.
Okay. A third of that? Half of it?
All right. So then start parsing. Like, one of the things that we just came out a couple of weeks ago with a report where we were asked by the legislature to kind of estimate what we needed for costs. And we'll see if it quite hits the target. I think for some folks, it's probably not going to be the kind of detail that they were hoping for. But when I sat down to start with my team coming up with concrete costs, we had a set of questions. Which costs are we talking about? Because, again, when you look at the entire Lake Champlain Basin, if we're talking about every rain garden that every resident in the state of Vermont might want to install, every, you know, inch of rock-lined ditches that put on every road, every new sediment pond that a developer puts into their thing, their parking lot, we just don't have the capacity to figure out all those costs. That's just, it's an impossible measurement to make. And there's too much uncertainty. I've used recently the example in some of my discussions with policymakers of Montpelier. If Montpelier, which I'm glad to say is stepping up to the plate and is starting to do some, take it much more seriously than they have in the past to deal with stormwater, but if they were going to go and tackle stormwater issues in that community, you know, and you've been to Montpelier, it's pretty developed right up to the edges of the Winooski River. You could talk about going property by property by property. And, you know, digging up the sidewalks, digging up the parking lots, and putting in sediment ponds. And that would be a massive, expensive undertaking. On the other hand, Montpelier's right in the middle of redeveloping a parking lot right in the center of town that's been a dirt lot and somewhat of an eyesore. And they have a wonderful plan for redeveloping that area. It's an ideal opportunity to build the costs of some stormwater controls into that plan. Mm-hmm. And it would be relatively inexpensive compared to the overall cost of the project. So when you're trying to estimate costs, I don't have the ability to kind of guess how each community is going to figure this kind of thing out. So what we've focused on is then, what are the costs that we think are fair to pass on to taxpayers, to the broader public, and to the businesses and the people and the farmers and people that, you know, are contributing to the problem? How do we allocate some amount of cost that we know will advance the cause, start to address the problems? So we've begun to identify some of those costs. We've figured that in the first couple of years, we'd like to raise another $4 to $6 million to get started. There's a substantial amount of planning and investing and helping communities and putting in place the programs we know that will lay the groundwork and foundation for this. And I, frankly, am punting on the bigger question of what's the overall long-term cost going to be, because I can't quite get my hands on it.
Okay, but you've just identified some $4 to $6 million. So let's talk about these proposals that have been talked about to raise some money. There's one that would be a per-parcel development fee. There's also an increased tax on fertilizer, about $1.5 million.
Well, I know that the report itself describes a couple of examples of how we might tier a parcel fee or an impervious cover fee, and says if we raised X amount, you know, it says that at X amount of dollars, it would raise about $1 million. It was just used as an example. We're actually right in the thick of, you know, with our pencils sharpened, working through how many parcels are we talking about? How many commercial, industrial, agricultural, institutional kinds of pieces of property do we have in the basin, and when you divide that into $4 million to $6 million, what do you come up with? What's the range of potential costs? So our plan is still to try to raise $4 to $6 million with that, plus probably a smaller amount of money associated with assessing a higher cost on fertilizer.
Okay. So these stories that talk about it raising $1.4 million, it's a lot higher than that.
Yeah, we're aiming for the $4 to $6 million range.
Okay, that's an important piece of information. Let me have you put those headphones on. 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Have you done anything to try to correct that number with anybody?
I have had a couple of conversations with reporters to ask them that in future articles when they describe it that they capture the 46 million. But I understand why it was reported the way it was, because those are the only specific numbers we listed in the report. And there was another section that described the overall goal, and I understand why people missed it.
Okay. All right. Glad to see I didn't take the approach of asking you why you weren't raising enough money, because there was an explanation. Right?
Yes.
You think you can get this proposal passed? It had a lot of resistance when it was an idea being floated last year.
I have high hopes for getting it passed. I think one of the things I got last year from talking with legislators was a concern, because the $155 million number kept floating around, and people were saying, that's just impossible, and they threw up their hands and walked away. And I said, well, no, come back to the table. Let's talk about how we can do this in increments and stages. And so I'm hopeful that we'll make some real progress this year.
Let's go to North Adamant. Fred, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, Commissioner. Commissioner, I was wondering if you've considered using Prison Industries to build manure pits on the farms and stuff. I mean, they make case goods for nonprofits, churches and like that, cabinets, benches, whatever and stuff, and taking that labor and leveraging your $1 to $4 million and doing like that.
Well, I like the idea of leveraging, you know, monies to make the best of things. I have to say the corrections, you know, industry or corrections system is not one that I interact very much with. So I'll take that idea and touch base with my friend, Commissioner Polito, to see what his thoughts are on that. But can I just take off on that just for a moment? Yeah. One of the ways in which we're looking at leveraging additional resources is in the use of the AmeriCorps program. We're in the discussions with the state leadership around AmeriCorps about whether or not we can get some additional federal grant dollars and AmeriCorps volunteers to work with local governments. These would be young professionals that could go work with local governments to help them design and build these new stormwater systems. I mean, one of the things that, you know, we all have experienced here in Vermont is that we all operate on a shoestring. And a lot of our government programs at the local level operate basically as volunteer systems. We've got a lot of people that aren't professionals, that aren't full-time staffs, and they need help. So we've been looking at the AmeriCorps program as one way that we might be able to help.
Are you allowed to use prisoners to do work from your department, things like that?
Not that I know of, but I've never asked that question before, and I just don't know the answer.
Let's go to Brookfield. Tom, how are you this morning?
Good morning. And Commissioner Mayers, I think you're doing a great job. You're in probably one of the toughest jobs in the state, as far as I can tell. The question that, as I watch this for years, I think Lake Champlain is a jewel in the crown of the state. It is probably one of the most spectacular things that we have to offer, as well as the Green Mountains. And I really think that what you said about a will, that people need a will to clean it up. It's not going to get better if we don't do anything. And I, for one, don't mind investing the money into the future. The issue that I see, you know, and I'm not a scientist, but it's the riparian buffer zones, and it's spraying manure right up to the edge of a field that has no barrier between it and a river that's on the watershed that drains directly into the lake. There was a big controversy, or not, I don't know whether controversy is the right word, but that's how I interpret it, about best management practices and some of these extremely large farms, which are quite honestly allowed to spray no matter what the field conditions are up till, I think it's December 15th, liquid manure on fields with no thought to whether it's going to rain the next day or whether it's raining when they spray it. So I see those as not the low hanging fruit, because I don't think it's the easiest because of the political pressure. But I see that as some of the larger polluters at that, and some stormwater issues. How do you address that kind of sacred cow of Vermont?
Okay, good questions. Thank you, Tom.
I'd say that Tom's hit probably is it Tom or Tony?
Tom.
Probably hit the most central question that we face. I think that figuring out how we address agricultural pollution is the single biggest kind of puzzle that we've got to sort through. And I think we've got a good start at it. And, you know, I'd encourage you at some point we should get Secretary Ross on this show to kind of describe in some more detail how he sees the set of issues fitting into his whole vision of agriculture in Vermont, because he has made this a real priority. And it's been a real pleasure to work with him through kind of trying to tackle this. But that the point about, you know, manure spraying is a great one. You know, we definitely have to figure out how to do a better job of that. One of the pieces of our proposal is to require that all of the applicators of manure, a lot of times it's farmers, particularly the smaller ones, will hire a company to come pump out their manure lagoon and spray it. And we've seen a lot of bad behavior, or maybe it's not bad behavior, it's uninformed behavior. And our hope is that by certifying, by kind of regulating the manure applicators more effectively, that that's when we will get some better practices by those folks. I also learned something disturbing the other day. There's been some great studies that we're in the process of doing because, again, you know, while we don't want to spend all this money on studies and not doing anything, we've been trying to focus increasingly on some specific studies about what works and what doesn't work, so that when we tell farmers to do stuff, to make changes in their practices, we know that there's going to be a benefit. And one of the outcomes of some of these studies, at least initially, is showing that it's how the farmers apply the manure or their specific practices on their farm that make the biggest difference. I was under the assumption that, for instance, that one of the bigger problems we've been facing is the increasing amount of corn that is grown in Vermont. And it is definitely a contributing factor. The more bare soil you have in the fall and the spring, when the corn is harvested or before it's been grown up, that's a really vulnerable time for a lot of soil. And it is also a time, particularly in the spring, when there's a lot of manure application happening. But it turns out that even when you've got hay pastures and you apply manure, if you do it in the wrong time, you know, as the caller identified, if you're applying your manure right before the rainstorm, that's the worst possible time to do it. And while that seems intuitive, oddly enough, I learned that in the past that the federal government has encouraged, or some scientists have encouraged farmers to apply the manure in the right before rainfall, because if the rain falls on it, the wisdom went that you would somehow allow more of the nutrients to get into the soil and you'd lose less of the nutrient value. But it just turns out that it also contributes massively to the amount of runoff, which is, of course, intuitive. So having learned that, we've realized we need to tackle that directly and reverse that. We need to go out there. We thought that these were farmers that were just simply disregarding good common sense, but it turns out someone had told them that this was the best way to proceed. So there's those kinds of things as we get deeper and dive into this that we're realizing.
244-1777, our local number, toll-free 877-291-8255. We're talking with Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner David Mears. We'll take a short break. We'll be back after these announcements.
Deer season is over,
but your chance to win a $300 gift certificate from Johnson Woolen Mills continues.
Simply come closest to correctly guessing the weight of the biggest rifle season buck registered with Vermont Fish and Wildlife as of December 11th without going over.
If you're 18 or older, send your guess, name, address, and phone number to P.O. Box 550 Waterbury. Fax it at 244-1771. Email WDEV@RadioVermont.com.
Or register your guess at the Johnson Woolen Mills Factory Store, Main Street, Johnson. Wear it for a lifetime.
But hurry, the deadline enters 5 p.m. Wednesday.
Thinking about doing some projects on your home? A home improvement loan from Granite Hills Credit Union is the answer. It's quick and easy. Borrow up to $10,000 with this personal loan at a great fixed low rate. No appraisal or title search required. Remodel your kitchen, replace your roof, or add a room. You decide. Looking to do a larger project? We have home equity loans with new lower rates or a line of credit that allows the flexibility of check writing. Give us a call, stop in, or visit us at granitehills.org to find out how you can make your remodeling dreams come true.
Granite Hills Credit Union is an equal housing lender and is federally insured by the NCUA.
Mooresville's newest store, Mattress Sofa Warehouse, you'll find lots of affordable gifts for Christmas. Literally hundreds of recliners starting at just $279. Hundreds of sleep sets with queen mattress sets starting at just $299. Affordable pillows, sheet sets, end tables, coffee tables, and more. Mattress Sofa Warehouse offers everyday fair pricing and everyday no interest payment options. Every day. Stop in at the brand new Mattress Sofa Warehouse, Gallery Lane, off the new Route 100 Mooresville Bypass. MattressSofaWarehouse.com.
Revitalizing Waterbury will once again host Wrap It Up and Win, an annual promotion that rewards you for shopping and dining locally during the holiday season. The play is simple. Every time you make a purchase from a local participating business, you get a stamp. Fill your card with 5 stamps, and you are entered to win prizes provided by more than 47 retailers, restaurants, and service establishments. Drawings are held every Monday for 4 weeks of fabulous prizes. Visit revitalizingwaterbury.org for all the details. This message is brought to you by the following merchants.
You're invited to enjoy a warm and tasty beverage at the Green Mountain Coffee Cafe and Visitor Center, located inside the historic train station in the heart of Waterbury. See you there.
From goggles and gloves to warm winter boots and socks, CC Outdoor Store has got you covered for the holidays. Located in the Twin Silos on Route 2, 1 mile west of Exit 10, CC Outdoors will help you get geared up for winter and fill your pack with great gifts.
No purchase necessary to win.
Tired of grocery shopping at huge supermarkets with no personality? This is Tom Mihuron, and I invite you to shop our well-stocked, right-sized family market in Waitsfield. Custom-cut meats, fresh seafood and produce, gourmet cheeses, regular and organic groceries, and over 1,000 wines. Come and see Jeff and Bill in the meat department, Tana in produce, Gary in seafood, Nate in the deli, or Nancy and Liz in our incredible wine department. Family-run for over 70 years. Mihuron Supermarket, Village Square Shopping Center in Waitsfield.
Back continuing our discussion, we've been talking this morning with David Mears. He's the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, talking about the cleanup of Lake Champlain, the efforts on the part of the Environmental Protection Agency to get Vermont to do that. And you know, I know there are a lot of people out there committed to making it happen, more than the EPA. All right, let's take a call from Morrisville. Chris, good morning. How are you?
Fairly well, thank you. I have a question. I've heard a couple of times that it's not really algae that we have in the lake, that it's a bacterial infection. I'm too old to remember my Latin, but it certainly did sound like a bacteria rather than an algae. Is that true?
All right.
It is true. Yeah, they it's referred to in the common vernacular as blue-green algae, but it's actually a bacteria. It's called a cyanobacteria. It's one of the most ancient forms of life on Earth.
So if we want to get the public will to remove it and get it under control, why don't we refer to it as what it is rather than a more benign-sounding algae?
Yeah, bacteria sounds scarier.
All right, I'll start talking about all the cyanobacteria out there.
Well, just call it a bacteriological infection. Second question is, with us damaging our farmlands, do you get gas over to Ticonderoga paper? Why are we not demanding if they take care of their plus 40-acre sludge field in the lake that's highly contaminated with mercury?
That's not, I'm not familiar with the sludge field associated with the natural gas pipeline.
No, over by
Ticonderoga paper.
Oh, I see.
Why, you know, if we're going to give them a big hand at the cost of our farmland, they ought to fix the damage they've done to the lake. And these things should be pushed. And the bacteria question is to protect the farmers and tourism. And we're either going to protect the lake or we're going to protect the others. And it's really a false economy to think that we would be truly helping tourism by allowing the lake to deteriorate. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your call.
Yeah, I'll just, there's no question that International Paper has obligations to protect the lake, and that's, of course, more in the purview of my colleagues over in the state of New York, but that's a good opportunity for me to mention that I have been in conversations with New York, and they are on their side also working towards improving the level of controls for phosphorus runoff. They haven't been pushed through the same formal legal process in the way that Vermont is being pushed right now by EPA. Although I hope that will change. They may not agree with that. But I do know that they're making progress, and we're sharing ideas and strategies.
What's your feeling about this pipeline that will be laid on the bottom of the lake here?
The pipeline, as I understand it, won't actually be laid on the bottom. They're going to do something called directional drilling, where they're going to go, I don't know, 30 or 40 feet under the lake bed through bedrock to come out the other side. So at the moment, my folks are evaluating what environmental impacts that may have. At first glance, it looks like there probably wouldn't be substantial impacts, but I don't...
Really?
Well,
I mean,
to
drilling
the
a hole 30 feet below the lake isn't going to have a substantial impact?
Right. My assumption is that it won't have that. But again, I've got my technical folks looking at it to kind of assess what those risks are. It's I have to admit, it's an issue that's outside of anything I've ever dealt with before.
Let's go to South Burlington. Bryce, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for this discussion this morning. Thank you, Commissioner Mears. Can we go back to the manure spreading for just a minute? I was wondering about that, you know, that it was mentioned that right before rainstorms would not be a good time to spread manure on the cornfields, and I know about there's a lot of cornfields. But, you know, I was thinking about that because if there's a lot of manure being spread in the spring and then probably quite a bit in the fall, too, you know, I mean, I've been living here since 1980, so it's not that long, but long enough to know that when I watch the weather forecast, you're pretty much looking at a rainstorm right around the corner every 2 days. So it seemed to me, you know, that's going to be a tough thing.
The other
thought was that seems that recently, it's just an observation, and I'm not sure if I have the days accurate, but recently there was a decision that it would not be a good idea to and try to enforce the agricultural safe practices stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it seems to me I was watching the local news just, I think it was a day or two after, where they had a fellow that was filmed, and he was dumping liquid manure straight into the river, into a river that went into Missisquoi Bay.
All right, let me have the commissioner comment on some of those. Can you start, Commissioner, with this ruling by the Secretary of the Agency of Agriculture, Chuck Ross, who rejected a petition that would have called on the state to enforce the new best management practices. Because you've been praising farmers, you've been praising the Agency of Agriculture. That would seem to go against your praise.
Well, Secretary Ross is probably the best person to speak to that decision since he made it. But what I understand about that decision is that it's a little more nuanced than he was just saying we're not going to do practices. There's some legal terminology around what's a, quote, best management practice under state, Vermont state law, and what's an accepted agricultural practice. And without going into the minutiae around that, I think that his decision turned on not wanting to be forced into the course of that petition, which had been filed by the Conservation Law Foundation, to apply a certain specific set of practices on farms under that circumstance. He was saying, we have this plan. We want to proceed with this plan to upgrade, to improve the accepted agricultural practices, to require things like fencing livestock out of streams, to improve the manure application practices, to address, you know, for instance, we probably need some better guidelines around when to apply before or after rainfall events, things like that. That's where he was saying he wanted to invest in that process, and he wanted to do it on his own timeline. He didn't want to do it under the pressure of, you know, with a gun to his head. I mean, then I think the final piece of that was...
So did you agree with his decision? Was he right in doing what he did?
I don't have any reason to disagree with it. I really wasn't involved enough in the details of the conversation he had with his team and the Attorney General's office around what the liabilities were.
Let me interrupt it. So you're the head of the Department of Environmental Conservation. That decision has a huge impact on what you do in your side of the ledger and what your efforts are. It plays right into it. So you talked about agriculture is the most important issue in pollution of Lake Champlain. So, I mean, was this the right call that he made? Because there are people that don't think it was.
Well, I guess what matters to me is less how the process by which we get to agricultural pollution controls. What I really care about is what are the actual controls that farmers are using, and are we requiring them to be used across the board in a more comprehensive and strategic way? That's what I care about. So how Secretary Ross and the Agency of Agriculture actually get there matters less to me. And what we've been focused on, and it's described in the state's implementation plan, is what I was describing, a whole set of improvements and upgrades to the practices that have been developed through about a two-year conversation that the Agency of Agriculture has been having with the farm and agricultural community, as well as with others, including some folks in the environmental community, to figure out what's that right suite of practices and then trying to get them applied. So as I understand his decision, it was he wanted to do it on that under that plan and not be kind of taken off course as a result of the petition. But I think one of the things that gets lost in the mix in these things when there's these, you know, procedural arguments, because we're so used to fighting about these issues, that's kind of the natural inclination. Everybody wants to kind of retreat to the corners because we're used to fighting about it. My hope, and honestly, and I hope this doesn't sound like a naive, like, can't we all, you know, get along and sing kumbaya, because I don't expect that. I expect that there will remain a set of tensions that are driven by the nature of the economic system that we live in and the different perspectives we all bring to these issues. But there really is a deep and shared commitment to reducing farm pollution that I've heard from farmers, from the Agency of Agriculture, as well, of course, the broader public. And increasingly, I believe that it's really about a mix of tools. There are farmers that just need to have a better set of and understandings and access to ideas and different practices. There are also farmers that are simply not interested in making any changes, and we need to step up to the plate and make them change their practices. The example of the video that Bryce described was a case in which we, and this is really thanks to an alert citizen who had their video camera and were out, and they saw something that didn't look right to them. They saw a farmer pumping out of their manure truck into a stream. And what it turned out when we investigated was that the farmer had already applied the manure to his field, but then went to the stream to rinse out his truck. So it wasn't pure manure that was going in the stream, but it was still illegal and the wrong thing to do. And when we confronted him with this video, he immediately agreed that he was in the wrong and, you know, has paid a substantial penalty. And we went to some effort with the Attorney General's office to make sure that information got out to the farm community, because we want to make sure everyone knows that's not an acceptable behavior.
All right, but let's talk a little bit broader here. I appreciate what you said about that specific case. But in terms of agricultural practices, there have been, over the past 5 to 10 years, a lot of discussion about best practices, implementing more things. Where is there any indication that any of those changes have resulted in less pollution?
You mean in terms of...
The lake is in worse shape than it was 15 years ago. Is that fair to say or not?
That is fair to say.
Okay. So there have been, over the past 10 to 15 years, a lot of discussion here in Vermont about having the agriculture community adopt best practices, not have their cows in the middle of the stream, etc. There doesn't, if the pollution is worse, there's not a lot of indication there that these best practices are working. Help me understand that.
Sure. And I think, and when we talk about that the lake quality is worse, partly what we're talking about is the in-lake concentrations of phosphorus, which have many different sources, which are all mixed together and end up in the lake. And so you can't kind of back up.
I understand, but you have, I think, correctly identified earlier in this program, the agriculture community is the biggest issue to deal with on this. So I'm not going to repeat my question.
Yeah, no, I wasn't arguing with that, with the premise of your question at all.
I just
kind of wanted to say that it's more complicated than just saying it's going up and agriculture is a primary cause. There are things that we know are working. And one thing that you'll see, if you were up in Franklin County, well, actually, it's with the snow, you wouldn't see this. But if you've been up in Franklin County in the last couple of weeks, you'd have seen that there's a lot more green across the landscape. Over the last couple of years, there's been a real increase in the amount of cover cropping, which is a terrific idea. It's the idea that instead of having all that bare dirt across the landscape in the fall, that farmers plant something like a cover crop, like rye, winter rye or a clover, and that holds onto the soil. The roots hold it. And there's all sorts of benefits in terms of reducing pollution and runoff. There are practices we know that work. And you can go, we can't measure the whole system, you know, farm by farm, but we've done, some of the recent studies that were done by Stone Environmental have gone farm by farm on a selected set of farms and seen what's worked and what's not. So we know that there are practices that reduce pollution. Fencing livestock out of streams we know works, and we have identified a number of places where that's happened. And as we project out forward, one of the reasons we're requiring more livestock fencing is we know it works, and we have projected the places that could reduce pollution. With all of that said, there are also trends working against us. Even at the same time, over the last decade, that we've intensively increased the amount of regulation of the large and medium farms, we've also seen that the methods of farming have changed. You know, we've shifted over the last couple of decades to liquid manure. We've shifted to a much higher level of annual crops like corn. We've also had other changes in the landscape. We've seen a lot more suburbanization, a lot more strip development happen. All these things are working in the wrong direction and against some of our efforts, and they kind of cloud our ability to show the successes that we'd like to show. Again, from my perspective, it all comes back to the idea, the main thematic I have, which is we have to bear down on this. This is not something where we're going to put in place a few feel-good, you know, practices on farms, and it's all going to get better. We really have to have a much more focused effort. And I'll just one last thought on that regard in terms of bearing down on the agricultural issues. One of the other issues that we realized as we have been talking about this over the last couple of years was that we had ignored an entire segment of the farm community, which are a lot of these dairies that are considered small dairies, less than 200 cows. That's still a lot of cows on any given one of those dairies. And when you add all of them up, it's half the cows in the state or so are these smaller dairies. Nobody has given them technical assistance. They've gotten a limited amount of financial resources, and we haven't regulated them. Not because the rules don't apply, but they apply in theory. But the Agency of Agriculture has not had the resources and staff to go work with those farms. That's an entire segment of the farm community. And oftentimes it's where we get the complaints about. Our plan is to actually dig into that, and that's a place where it's going to require some more money and resources, but we think it's worth it. We expect we'll see big returns.
We're talking with David Mears, the Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation. I want to get back to the phones here, but we're just talking about development. Can Vermont continue to just develop the way that it wants to and not have it work against those trends, the other efforts that you've been talking about?
Well, my sense of the way Vermont wants to develop is when I talk to communities and community leaders, what they reflect is a desire to kind of maintain the classic iconic Vermont landscape, which is to invest in our village centers, our towns, and to protect the working landscape of forests and farms. And yes, if that's what Vermont wants for a landscape, that works directly in favor of managing our water pollution issues, because that landscape is our best investment.
Okay.
Against water pollution.
All right. That's not happening in Chittenden County.
It's true. And I think, you know, it remains one of the reasons that we work with the Agency of Commerce and Community Development, the regional planning commissions, and local governments to try to talk what are the barriers to the development in the places we want to happen. You know, this is, you know, outside the purview, at least directly, of water pollution. But one of the programs we have in our department is to encourage and promote the development of what are called brownfield sites. And one of the reasons that developers don't want to build in communities is every time they turn over a shovel full of soil, they bump into petroleum-contaminated soil or some mess that's expensive and complicated to clean up. Whereas if you go out in a farm field, it's, you know, it's a lot cheaper and easier. It's more expensive. You may run into historic buildings when you're in downtowns, and that's a whole set of regulations and, you know, cost. So we've been working with other agencies to think about how do we remove those barriers to development in those places so that more of the development can happen there as opposed to out across the landscape.
Do there need to be any restrictions put into place in a place such as Chittenden County on development?
I think that the communities are realizing that they need to limit the amount of development that happens in places that are vulnerable, whether it's floodplains, wetlands, farm fields. Yes, I think, you know, we need to continue to reinforce Vermont's longstanding commitment to restricting development in those places and encouraging it in places where we want it to happen, like village centers and downtowns.
Let me ask the question another way. Do the regulations take into account enough the effect that these projects might have on Lake Champlain and other waterways?
I don't think that we have fully taken those kinds of considerations into account, nor do I think we've fully taken into account the impacts on our ability to be resilient to future flood impacts. I think one of the things I saw as a result of Irene, that we have a lot of communities that have allowed development in floodplains and along river corridors in places just shouldn't be. Those putting aside pollution issues, that's just unsafe and results in too much economic damage. And it also contributes to water pollution, because when we end up putting homes and businesses, you know, in places along and floodplains and river corridors, it also increases the amount of erosion associated with flood events.
Let's go to Corinth Forbes. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Going back into real time here, many years ago, the agricultural community and farms were tenfold as to what we have today. And probably some of the guidelines of manure spreading and various other things were a lot more lax than they are today. We had an abundance of quality fish in Lake Champlain. I don't ever remember flumes of algae and everything else, although the agricultural community was tenfold of what we have today. I really think it gets into the development area. If you take a look under everybody's sink and in the laundry room, you'll see materials there that are greater than anything a farmer could ever produce, and every bit of it going down the drain and into our system.
All right, let me have him address that question. Thanks, Forbes.
Well, I think looking at the historical development of Vermont is an important set of considerations, and I can't pretend to be an expert on how the landscape has evolved, and I don't think people have fully, you know, grokked or figured out exactly what all these causes are. But I think one thing that's happened in farming over the last decades has been there's been a shift away from the smaller farms that are based on kind of pasture-based feed for cows, and to these larger farms where liquid-based manure and annual corn crops. And it's the mixture of the liquid manure systems where when you feed, this is a little gross, but when you feed cows hay, when they feed in the pasture, their manure is solid, relatively solid. When you feed them corn or grain, which can produce more milk, you produce liquid manure. And there's some efficiencies to that, but there's also cost because you have a lot more of this material you've got to control and manage and apply to the landscape. And so the combination, I think, of liquid manure, more corn cropping, larger farms have contributed to a change in the way that we farm. And I'm not sure that it's true that while the number of farms may have gone down, I don't think that the number of overall animal units or cows has gone down. So I think those are some variables that work against the idea that it's all development. But on the other hand, I don't really disagree with Forbes that development is a significant part of the issue. And, you know, I've only been living in or, you know, visiting Vermont since the early days when I came here to go to law school. But I've seen in that short amount of time a dramatic change in that, you know, the trip that I used to make from South Royalton up to Burlington is a very different trip than it was, you know, 30 years ago. And so and there's no question that all that development in the Winooski Valley is contributing to more phosphorus and nutrient pollution into the river and ultimately into the lake.
So when I suggested that this proposal and the effort that you're putting into this, the money you're raising and the plan that you've presented to the EPA is weak tea, you reject that.
Yeah, it's not weak tea. It may not be strong enough tea. I'm not suggesting that we've got it all figured out and it's perfect. But I feel really positive. In all honesty, of all the things I've done in my professional career, the development of this plan, because it's strategic, it's identified at the major sources, it's cost effective, I just don't see how we can't do it. If we have to implement this plan, it is the best approach that I've been able to devise that I think that we can get through the legislature, that the farm community can support, that the business community can support, and that Vermonters should be able to get behind. It may not get us all the way there. It probably won't. But it's the best step that I can imagine us taking, and it's not a small step.
And are the trend lines, I mean, you talked about these other factors that are really coming into play here. I mean, are these trend lines going to overwhelm what you want to do?
Well, one of my fears, you know, you have a way, Mark, of getting, you know, to my deepest fears. And, you know, one of my fears is that these broader trends in farming and the way that farming's, you know, practices are changing, and the way that development and sprawl continue to happen, exacerbated by the increased amounts of rainfall associated with climate change, are really working in the wrong direction. At the same time, a lot of the things that we've tried to identify in this plan are things that address all of those at once. Something, you know, keeping development out of floodplains has water quality benefits, it has climate benefits, and it reduces the amount of economic damage we face. When we can find those win-win-win kinds of solutions as a state and as a community and make those investments, we'll be headed in the right direction and turning that trajectory in the right angle.
Share with us your other deepest fears, please, Dave. Thank you for coming in. We should mention before we wrap up here, you have on Saturday, there's a Waterbury Dam event, real quick here.
That's correct. Yes, as folks in Waterbury know, there's been a fair amount of discussion around what the conditions are going to be associated with our relicensing of the Waterbury Dam. There's a public hearing about our proposed decision this Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Crossett Brook Middle School.
Right here in Waterbury. Thank you for coming in. David Mears is the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation. It's a department within the Agency of Natural Resources. We're going to take a break here for news. Coming up next hour, we're going to talk about property taxes. We'll have a couple of folks here from the Public Assets Institute who argue against what seems to be the universal feeling out there that school spending is out of control. They'll join us coming up at 10:15. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren and AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier. News is coming your way next.
AP Radio News.